Welcome. I'm Harmony Slater, your host of the Finding Harmony podcast. Over the past 20 years, I've taught thousands of yoga teachers and students to explore the intersection between ancient wisdom and modern everyday life using mind-body practices to heal, awaken, and manifest their dreams from the inside out. This podcast is a sanctuary for those feeling overwhelmed by life's challenges. Are you ready to jump in and discover how these challenges aren't actually in the way, but are the way to finding harmony? Let's invite the magic back in. Well, hello, and welcome to the Finding Harmony podcast. We have an incredible episode for you today, speaking with someone who I am always inspired by and love connecting with. He is so heart-centered and just a brilliant mind, an incredible energy in the world. And I just am so grateful to know him as a human being. And I'm very excited to see him coming up shortly at the end of May, because today we are meeting with Alexander Medine. He has been traveling and teaching yoga for over 20 years, for a long, long time. In 2002, he was certified by Patabi Joyce in Mysore, India. And we've been friends for many years. He is just a bright light in this world and someone who actually has translated the Yoga Sutras and the Bhagavad Gita into Norwegian. And in 2015, he took over what was then sort of a mountain lodge and turned it into a beautiful retreat center called Nosen Retreat Center. And we are talking to him today about what inspired him to do this, the story of how Nosen was created. And I'm very thrilled to say that I will be there at the end of May teaching a retreat in this beautiful mountain lodge in Norway, and I would love for you to come find me there. But more importantly, we're also talking about two incredible projects that he founded and originated. The first is called Gangster Yoga, which is an NGO that is focused on helping the youth at risk and also people who are incarcerated or imprisoned, giving them opportunities and supporting them in their transition out of prison into the world, also teaching yoga classes in the prison to help them learn to breathe and feel discomfort and to give them the tools to create greater clarity of mind and connect somatically with their body, and supporting them often as they're transitioning out of prison and coming back into regular life, which can be a very difficult time for people. And also Back in the Ring, which is an incredible project as well that really speaks to these issues of addiction. And so I think you'll find this very fascinating. It's a project that Alex started where he's supporting drug addicts and people struggling with addiction of all types and all sorts to use the practices of yoga, breathing, pranayama, breath work, meditation techniques to help them develop greater self-awareness and to use these practices and these techniques so that they can step out of addiction and feel more joy and satisfaction and really re-engage with society, giving them hope and fulfillment, and getting them involved in some incredible projects in India as well as in Norway. So we're going to talk to him about all of these things today, and I'm just really, really excited. I can't wait to jump into this episode and connect with Alex, and I hope you're excited about it too. And let's dive in now. Hi, welcome to the Finding Harmony podcast. I'm here today with Russell Kay.
Harmony.
Hi.
I learned something interesting recently. We'd been approached by Duolingo, the language app. They're going to offer us 45 cents every time I use the word Duolingo
Oh, gosh.
On the podcast. And I've been learning Swedish.
Yeah.
Because obviously I discovered our family in a headstone, a grave in Algutsdorp near Göteborg. And now I'm very excited. And we're going to go to Sweden and study and teach yoga.
Next year.
And I've been learning Swedish. You know what I learned?
What?
This is how you say good morning in Swedish.
Mm-hmm.
Good morgon.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the same in Norwegian, Alex?
God morgon. Yeah.
In Norwegian,
in Swedish, it's god morgon. God morgon.
Morgon.
In Norwegian, it's more like god morgon. God morgon.
But good moron is really offensive.
It's not moron. It's morong.
No. I just looked it up just to make sure for this bit, for this joke. I just looked it up. And it sounds the same, and it's very offensive in English. I can't go to Göteborg, and then say good morons to the whole class like that. I can't do that.
Sure you can.
For those who don't understand English, they would just feel you being polite, trying to talk the language.
It's condescending to you.
That's right. Well, our guest today is...
Did you learn English through...
I need to introduce him.
But did he use Duolingo to learn English?
No, he didn't.
Because your English is perfect. Did he use Duolingo? Did he use the language app Duolingo?
Never used it. In Norway, we grow up watching English television, from an early age, watching Hollywood movies. So that's how, apart from school, that's where we learn to speak English. And you don't, in Norway, it's only 5 million people. So you don't get very far. So you have to learn another language.
Oh, you wouldn't even speak Norwegian
very much.
You don't
get very far.
there's not many people to speak it to, is there? Everywhere I go, I meet someone speaking English. But if I only met a Norwegian once a day, I'm all day watching TV, then yeah.
You'll learn English. So today our guest is Alex Medin. Hello, Alex. We're so happy
Alex Medin.
To have you today here.
Hi, Armani. We're looking forward to have a visit from you in Norway soon too, in the end of May. Yes.
Yes, the end of May, I will be coming to, how do you say it? Nøsen? Is that how you say it? But it has a long, much longer name.
Nøsen. We have like a dirga, like a long vowel.
Nøsen. Ah, beautiful. And then how do you say, I think it says yoga retreat, but in Norwegian?
It's an English word. We say yoga retreat center, but Nøsen is kind of like a, also hotel. We called it Nøsen Yoga and Mountain Lodge in English, but in Norwegian it's actually Nøsen Yoga and Mountain Hotel.
Uh-huh. How do you say it in Norwegian?
Fjell hotel. It's like a mountain.
Fjell hotel.
Would you nice. Pronounce the G in Swedish? Is it Yoa? Yoa?
In Norwegian, you mean?
Because they don't do the G in Swedish. It's really
weird.
They
don't?
Yeah.
That's sloppy. That's the kind of sloppy people. We say yoga. It's the G's. Is the
Swedish are sloppy people.
No.
My grandparents were sloppy. Yeah, yeah.
That's why Norway will be taking over Sweden. Yeah, they have no future.
Oh, they should. They should. It would help those people.
Yeah.
Whenever I think of Norway and Sweden and Holland and I think of all the Viking tribes warring with each other.
Yeah. And the Swedes with the sloppy Vikings.
But everybody knows that the Vikings came from Norway, it's from the inner fjords on the west coast of Norway. Sweden claimed to have Vikings, but everybody knew they came to Norway. Then they went to Sweden, then they went to the Baltic Sea and all other places.
Yeah, yeah. This Russia is actually Swedish, is what I understand.
It's Sweden.
The Rus from Sweden. It's a tribe from Sweden. They went down to the Baltic Sea and they took over Istanbul and they became Russia.
But they were originally Norwegian.
The Russians are originally Swedish.
What do you think?
I think that, everything points to Norway. It's the northern way, the northern lights, the Nordic Sea. It's the top of Europe. Of course,
This may be our most unpopular episode in Sweden.
Yeah.
So you'll see it, you know, when you finally come here. And Norwegian have something special. And they say, you know, this is a standing joke. But why? Because, you know, Norwegian oil fund, since the government was very smart in the 70s and early 80s, the kind of Norwegian oil fund, instead of letting the foreign investor control our oil, they started a kind of Norwegian, it was called a pension fund, but it's how they kind of invested all the money from the oil industry. So Norwegian kind of state deposit is doing very well now due to the kind of rich oil reserves that we have. So it's a standing joke among the Swedes that they say, you know, why the Norwegian have so greasy hair is because the oil has risen to our head.
Oh, my word. Harmony and I are looking for a place to retire. Is Norway open to foreign immigration?
Not so much.
You have to be part of the EU. We can give you a special deal at Nursen. We can give you a cabin, maybe.
Okay.
You can stay there for parts of the year.
Oh. Yeah, we can live out our retirement years like as a indentured servant. We can just cook and clean and live in the mountains.
Yeah, we can give you a snowmobile and some skis, and you can be happy there, you know.
Oh. Yeah, good.
Alaska Huskies, and you can have your own sledge, and yeah.
Yeah.
Paradise. Awesome. But it's like you do in Canada, right?
Yes, it's very, I think the climate's very similar to Canada. We have,
we don't have as warm.
All four seasons.
Yeah, very strong four seasons. Unfortunately, our summers is not as hot as yours, I guess. It only goes up to about 30 degrees maximum.
Okay.
My ancestry app says I have 6% Norwegian. It's 38% Swedish, but like that 6% should give me like a passport, I think.
You can try to apply.
I'll write a letter.
We're open to immigration. You know, we need only being 5 million people.
You need some people. You know,
the baby boom is way past its peak. So we need people.
Yeah. Young people, though.
Yeah.
Not us. Working
you
people.
Have to be below 30, 40. So yeah.
Exactly. But when I met you, we met in India, and if people want to hear about your journey to yoga, they can listen to our past episode where we went in depth into boxing and ballet and stowing away on a ship and all kinds of incredibly adventurous tales. But when we met, I think you had just finished your master's degree in yoga in philosophy, right? In Eastern philosophy or yoga studies. And then you were studying Sanskrit very intensely and living in India. Then you started living
in
India.
In Mysore, in the Mysore College of Sanskrit.
Yeah.
Which is, no one was doing that.
Patashala.
Sanskrit Patashala, yes.
Yeah. You had a kind of stature that was, you know, head and shoulders above the normal kind of yoga bohunks that were just kind of strutting around. Like you were really... You're quite serious about it, and in a way that, you know, maybe the rest of us were just kind of dumb athletes. It was incredible to me.
Well, thank you. I didn't really think about it myself at the time because I was like a dog at a bone with Sanskrit. I just loved it, and it was such a privilege to be around these great teachers at the Sanskrit College and just learning Sanskrit, you know, in a conversational manner, studying the text, talking about it in Sanskrit afterwards. Of course, it was a privilege when you studied in the West with a kind of very slow manner, where you always had your thick Monier William dictionary on the side and you're kind of flicking it, spending half of your time just looking in the dictionary. So being in Mysore with some of these great teachers was very rewarding. So, I felt a little kind of awkward just like hanging around in Mysore. You know, people went to yoga classes in the morning, and what do you do rest of the day, right? I didn't like sleep. Hanging around by the pool. So it became like just using the time to my best of my capacity. So I just kind of totally dove into the Sanskrit studies and got a very great connection with some of the people there. And they really, influenced me in a fantastic way. And I never really thought about it at the time when I first came to India, because I never really planned to become a yoga teacher. But then all the time I spent studying Sanskrit was, of course, incredibly helpful to all my yoga studies and my later teaching of yoga.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, I mean, it is amazing. I think you must have so much energy because you also were doing like an incredibly advanced practice, you know, practicing third series and some of fourth series and, you know, becoming
next to you. It was exactly that. It was so much energy where I'm like, I'm dead dog tired. And I'm like watching you like, yeah, with enthusiasm. Like they say in the Yoga Sutras, practice with enthusiasm. And he had that. I'm like, I don't have that.
So much tejas, fire, right?
Mm. You know, we all come into life with different energy. I kind of came into life with a breech birth, you know, so I had to kind of work my way through. And ever since I survived that first birth, I'm full of energy. Life is easy after that. So I guess that was also the typical ADHD child that was full of energy. I couldn't really sit still at school. And to me, yoga was just coming home. And I feel so infinitely grateful for all the time I had in Mysore, all the time I had with yoga. And hold on one second. There's a guy calling me who his daughter is relapsing. So I just need to help him one second.
Take your time. Yeah.
Yeah, it's fine. Call him later.
That's a good segue. I think this is a great opportunity to talk about this too, because, you know, having so much energy and, like you said, maybe a little ADHD, right? Like so much energy in this world thinking. I mean, your mind must think very, very quickly.
You walk much faster than me. I noticed that. When we were in Taiwan together, I could barely keep up with you on the street.
Through yoga, though, you've like been able to channel, it seems like, this energy and your thoughts and your mind and like really accomplish some very incredible things for yourself, but then also now kind of channeling that energy into, I mean, helping others in a pretty important and significant way.
Let me ask you a kind of maybe a more dire personal question. With all of that drive, did you yourself ever feel the need to maybe take substances to calm yourself down and get into a cycle of addiction with something like that?
No, never. It was like kind of always.
No.
Okay. Some people seek that in life, you know, as a kind of release from trauma and deep, deep pain. And maybe I was never really aware of my pain. That's why I was maybe racing around. But I always had, surplus of energy and feel grateful for that. And always wanted to kind of embrace life and be awake to mm-hmm. all the great things that is here and now all around. And I had a few years in my end of my teens where I was kind of doing drugs and smoking a lot of dope and things like that. But that was more like a mental escape from various family issues.
But not a cycle of addiction. It was just entertainment.
It kind of spiraled into a lot of detrimental negative consequences, and I ended up in prison and stuff like that. But then eventually I moved out of Norway and spent 23 years abroad, you know, part of that living in Sweden, studying classical ballet for 3 years and working as a ballet dancer for 5 years, and then later going to London to study at SOAS and getting a degree in comparative religion and Sanskrit. And then taking a master's later and being introduced to yoga in the mid-90s kind of gave me in the beginning, it was just a beautiful way of practicing. It felt like, wow, this is incredible energy, this practice. It kind of fires me up. It makes me a better dancer. And I have to do this in order to kind of be at my, you know, be on my edge, be at my peak. But then later, the kind of the interest in dance, theater, things like that just faded away because I was so absorbed by yoga. And maybe that was just my nature. When I got into something, it was just like totally focused, and all other things were just kind of slipped. But you know, and the end of the story is, I had a lot of energy. And when I moved back to Norway 14 years ago, I felt incredibly privileged to have been taught yoga, to know a little bit of yoga. And I wanted to share that with the kind of less privileged people that came to yoga rather than the, you know, rich housewives and high performers that, who, you know, had the privilege to go and to follow the yoga bus, the pop culture of yoga. So I started teaching in prison and started teaching yoga for drug addicts. And slowly, slowly it grew and become a positive thing. And then in 2015, about 9 years ago, I've been working with some inmates, and I was thinking, shit, these people have nowhere to really go. And, you know, after they've been doing their time to have something constructive and helpful. So I came across this old derelict hotel, and I just kind of thought, how difficult can it be to run a hotel? I took it over, and then we started a yoga retreat center. And now it's a kind of full-time operational yoga hotel. And, you know, we feel like we're in John Cleese's Faulty Towels, you know, we're like totally, we don't know what we're doing.
Inmates running the asylum.
Due to the great interest in yoga and due to the great interest and the great service that a lot of the inmates and former drug addicts gave back, we were able to kind of staple something on top of each other until it became a company that is now working well, you know, and it's like serving a lot of people and having 7-8 people full-time employed, and then, you know, a lot of extra people that come there and work part-time and volunteer.
I feel like the seeds of this dream were kind of, I think when we actually very first met for the first time, it might have been in Thailand at Paul Delahan's retreat center.
Yeah.
And I think you were quite interested in like this retreat center idea and kind of like not thinking of starting one, but like also just like thinking that it was like a really interesting kind of concept to have a yoga retreat center.
Definitely. I mean, like you could say that the first real mentor on the path of, you know, starting yoga retreat center was definitely Paul Delahan at Samahita in Thailand. But it started, I think, even before that, because did you ever go to Swamiji's place in BR Hills?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I visited Swami, and he said, like, well, you should, he just said, you should start a retreat center in Norway, yoga retreat center. And we called it, what should we call, like, Jivamrita Yoga, something like that, you know? And he laughed and said, yeah, I can create great food and just make it happen, you know, like God's will. And I was like, that's where the kind of seeds were planted. And then I met Paul first time in India, I think 2001, 2002. And he started telling me about Yoga Thailand. He says, please come for a visit. And accidentally, you know, I was actually going to Kuala Lumpur to help a person set up a yoga retreat center there. But then something came in the way and it didn't really work. And then suddenly Paul called me out of the blue because he and Jutima was expecting a baby. He said, hey, Alex, can you come and help us here for a couple of months? And I said, sure, you know. And I came there, and then I got introduced to Ingo, you know, at the Mandarin Oriental. Oh, and yeah, I went to Hong Kong. So I went to Hong Kong to work for the Mandarin Oriental, the super hotel.
So what a crazy adventure. And eventually, though, what brought you back to Norway? How did you end up taking this circle all the way back home? I feel it's a bit like Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz.
I wish I could say anything. It was something great, aspirational, but it was something it was heartache. I was crushed. I was gutted. I was floored with a heartache when I lived in Hong Kong. There was a woman we were supposed to get married, and I was like totally head over heels in love with her. And then she totally broke my heart. And I just like, shit, what do I do now? You know, because like I built my world around that we're going to be together for the future. And then suddenly all those kind of airy castle just crushed to the ground. And for, I guess, 3 months, I kind of cried and was felt so sorry for myself. And then I just decided, okay, I need to go home to Norway to be with my friends, speak my language. And so that's when I moved back to Norway in 2009, actually. And then I just started, had to help build up Turo Yoga, which is a great yoga studio in Oslo, and taught Mysore style there basically for six years. And then I took over Nursen.
I just want to say that it's not an indictment of Hong Kong. Women will break your heart in any country.
But although it was a terrible heartache at the time, we all go through phases in life. And, you know, when somebody does something to you, you think that, oh, that person is bad or whatever. How could she do that? But, you know, we all also carry our own stuff. And for me, that was a trigger to get in touch with some of my own pain. Because, you know, yeah, I had a lot of energy, but a lot of my life also, I, of course, ran away from some pain and challenging from the past and childhood and stuff like that. But I, despite all that, I was always positive with life. But that kind of soreness, and she touched a kind of very raw chord in me, you know, where all the walls and defenses totally broke down. And sometimes we need that as a little reset. And to me, that kind of heartache was a reset to kind of, okay, what is important? What do I really need to do? And I just felt, okay, going home to Norway. I came home with two empty hands. I had nothing. I lived at Puru Yoga at the kind of back room. I had to wait for all the people to finish showering and going to the toilets before I could go to bed at night. And then eventually, you know, I just wanted to share yoga, and then great things happen from that. And I feel infinitely, infinitely grateful. And, you know, to kind of crown the story, of course, I eventually met a great woman, which I'm now married to, and we have a wonderful child, and I have two bonus kids, you know, so, and we have a great house in Hemsedal. So life is really sweet and beautiful, but how brutal it was. Like 15 years ago, I thought I was going to die, you know, from pain, just from being lost in this image of how I wanted life to be. And then I was like, needed to shift focus, and it was supposed to do something else. But anyway, that's the story of how I ended up in Hong Kong. And yes, prior to that, it was Paul Daligan, I guess, and seeing his retreat center and how smooth and easy he was running it, you know, and I was thinking, that this is something I also wanted to do. And I feel infinitely grateful that it happened one day.
Yeah.
I'd like to just piggyback on that for just a moment about gratitude, because it's amazing how a system can affect your life or affect someone's life and what they do in that system. It can really severely abuse people and make them for the worse. But in the short period in the United States, the prison system was really trying to rehabilitate people. And so when my father was in federal prison, he was in a special program at a federal penitentiary in Lexington, Kentucky, where they were really trying hard to offer beneficial programs to help people. So my father studied music and painting, and he had yoga classes in 76, 77, 78. And when he came out, he was just a very healthy person. He was sober, and he did yoga in the morning, and then he would paint. And I would go into his studio, little boy in love with his father, and so happy to have him back. And I would watch him paint, and I have one of his paintings in my room that inspires me when I'm painting. And I feel like that choice of a country and of a nation to say we're going to rehabilitate our felons instead of punish them has been the crux of my life, that political choice, that now I have the means in which to self-care, and I have the means in which to flourish because of the way that my father was treated in prison. And so I just want to say, when you spoke of gratitude, it's like I have that gratitude for the way that my father was treated, and that your choice to participate in that kind of rehabilitation means a great deal, not just to that man, but to his family and to how his family carries samskara forward through generations.
That's beautiful to hear that and to kind of feel how that influenced your father. And, you know, the sad thing is that anybody going to prison, unfortunately, end up worse than better most of the time, unless they have a very good rehabilitation program and is allowed to do creative things. And also that it could be somehow, you know, a prison sentence should ideally be a kind of personal retreat where you kind of work on yourself and you come out as a better person. But when you're locked down and, you know, feel traumatized because you can't deal with your anger and frustration and, you know, people tell you what to do all the time when you're trying to apply for things and nobody want to listen to you, it's very, very frustrating. And I've seen a lot of kids actually get mentally very negatively affected by being in prison, and eventually they become pacified and careless about life rather than seeing the richness and fullness and the beauty of life, you know. But when these walls are shut down and you have like nowhere to go, nothing to deal with, you know, you also close down some walls inside of you and you become bitter and you become hard. And, you know, there's a saying that, yeah, the prison walls is hard to get out of, but the prison walls you built inside of you from simply being in prison, because you become tough in order not to feel emotion and feel helpless and sad, that's almost worse. So part of that, you know, keeping that in mind was one of the reasons why I wanted to bring yoga to the prison system. And it can be a beautiful thing if people are open to it and willing to try it. And for some people, of course, it's just a waste of time. They want to, you know, lift weights or do other things. But to at least have that opportunity in the prison system to kind of let down the defense mechanism, learn to relax, learn to find peace of mind, experience the inner sense of harmony. That is what people need in order to kind of start, you know, getting in touch with the real values of life. Until you do that, you're kind of caught in denial or you're caught up in anger. And if you're caught up in anger, you know, there's like a prison wall that holds you back from just simply relating to life.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the things that you've observed? Like, you must have regular students that are coming to your classes. You must, are they like in prison for life? Do they get out of prison? Like, what are some of the things that you've observed from working?
You mean in prison? Yeah. What I observed is that, yeah, you know, I've worked with, you know, prison people who are there for life to, you know, 20 years, 10 years, 5 years, a few years. And some of them in the beginning are very, very suspicious of yoga. They just come maybe because they're bored and they want to fill their time, or, you know, sometime out of curiosity. But when you give people the opportunity and consistency over time, you know, something change when they get a practical experience of learning to let go, learning to relax, learning to feel that they disconnect themselves from all the noise in their head, you know. But, you know, people are very different. Individuals are different. Some people take to it very quickly. And like, I was in the prison today and I met one guy. He's only in his 40s and he's been to prison for 20 years and did a program with him 10 years ago. And he came to me today and kind of embraced me and said, thank you, thank you, thank you. Sorry, I was so ungrateful and I had cocky and full of attitude 10 years ago. But I tell you, he said, like, that yoga program we did, it's kind of gave me a new rebirth, he said. He says it was like he was liberated finally from just some deep, deep stuff. And, you know, he's been seriously medicated by the government because he was a heroin user and, you know, been, so he was on, you know, heavy Subutex substitute and a lot of other benzo treatment. But just to see him, he's still struggling with his stuff, but just to see how, you know, 10 years ago, that yoga practice, how much that affected him. And he feels that now he's reading a lot of, you know, books on Buddhism and yoga and things like that. And he just, and he told me, like, you know, the greatest thing, just make sure you harm nobody, he said. That's the greatest law. Cause no violence, whatever. And for him to learn that, it was a beautiful thing. So people are very different. This guy was obviously, you know, when he first tried it, he had a bit of an attitude problem. But then eventually, you know, anybody who learns to, if they're able to turn their focus and attention inward and to experience the kind of polar opposites of emotional stuff that goes on in our body. And once there is a subtle experience of balance and inner harmony, you know, that's a beautiful tool to put people on the right path. But then, you know, I taught people yoga and I thought they did really, really well and they got out of prison and still, you know, a few months later, they're back in prison. So it's not always, it isn't, by no means is it a wonder cure, of course, but it's the best tool I come across. Rather than to sit and talk to a shrink about mental problems and you repeat your story again and again from the past, you know, and all your problems and trauma and why life is difficult. With yoga, there's like a direct experience of breathing and learning to become just present in the moment. And if you teach people that, it can be a wonderful tool for improvement.
Can I ask you, we had this experience working with Title I communities and in tough schools and inner city neighborhoods that the problem of vulnerability and vigilance. When in this environment, vigilance is what's keeping you alive, keeping you safe. Vigilance is protecting you, protecting your reputation from harm, which is all you have if you have nothing. And then to go in and say, we're going to do a downward dog, or we're going to do a back bends, or even just relax. These things are so contrary to maintaining vigilance. What techniques do you use to kind of help people with lowering their guard when their guard is keeping them safe?
Yeah. Well, in the beginning, I tried taking them straight through an Ashtanga practice, you know, hoping that this is going to work. And it's just made them even more vigilant. So, you know, I learned from trial and error. And now I just make them lie down on the floor and breathe, basically. Breathing, you know, balanced breathing, and then eventually working on trying to kind of stimulate the parasympathetic nervous system rather than the sympathetic nervous system that is all fired up. So I start with calm breathing, like 5 seconds in, 5 seconds out, letting them feel that and connect with kind of beingness. And then eventually I start teaching them to, you know, say breathe in 5 seconds and exhale 10 seconds and sometime hold a little bit after the exhalation just to feel safe. And that's their kind of first introduction to yoga. And a lot of people are just happy, you know, I could finally sleep, I could let go. And some of them is just happily snoring, just being lost in dreams. But and then gradually I'd do some yoga gentle exercises, lying down on the floor, just kind of cuddling. But what you say is there is this strong sense of vigilance almost for most inmates because you're always on guard because that somebody could explode is very present and palpable. And some people are walking on eggshells, you know, in order not to create noise, and they're afraid of, constantly afraid. And other people, they are just like super hard and tough and being out of touch with anything. But what I experience is that that vigilance is a way of coping with life. And some people have never experienced anything else. And that's why they have problems falling asleep. And then they are totally dependent on seductives in the prison. And they need sleeping pills in order to, you know, just knock themselves out. Mm-hmm. But they're the most beautiful thing I know. And this is why I'm doing it, still teaching in the prison, is because when these kind of hardcore criminals finally lower their guards and experience beingness rather than hardness and oneness rather than total, you know, and diversity, there is a potency of energy that is so strong. You could feel it in the room when these people lower their guard and they finally relax and, you know, they come and hug you and there is something beautiful. And you say, yes, some of them has done some terrible stuff and they need to be in prison. But at least giving them the tool or opportunity to experience a greater state of being rather than this inner tension, strain and hardness and vigilance all the time. I find yoga is a beautiful tool to see how they soften, lower their guard and dare to be vulnerable. And of course, that's where all the great strength in life is. Everybody knows that who has dared to work through some stuff. You need to be vulnerable in order to be strong. Otherwise, you break sooner or later.
Yeah. Beautiful. And I'd love to hear, so you started working in the prisons and then you kind of developed this program of rehabilitating drug addicts or working with drug addicts through a rehabilitation program. And then this kind of eventually led into using Nosan. Nosan. As like part of this bigger vision and project. Can you talk a little bit about what, like how that all came about?
Well, how it came about, actually, you know, I had this idea in the back of my mind that I always wanted to run a yoga retreat center. But of course, I wasn't there, you know, and I thought about, oh, having it in Thailand or India, somewhere beautiful, you know, but I didn't have much money and things like that. So when I came back to Norway, I let that idea go a bit, you know, that I would, you know, oh, wow, I'd love to have yoga retreat. But then, you know, funnily enough, the spring of 2013, I drove with my son, Benjamin. I just, you know, bought him a secondhand car and we were driving up in the mountains and we were driving by this beautiful place. And I stopped there and I said to Benji, wow, imagine having a yoga retreat center in this location. That would be awesome, you know? And then I didn't think more about it. I just kind of, it was Easter 2013 and then the summer came and I had some savings that I, you know, made from yoga and stuff like that. And I wanted to do this summer project with drug addicts in Oslo. So I went around Oslo and going down to the places where the drug addicts are and some institution and just recruiting them and say, hey, I have this project I want to do for 8 weeks. And if you succeed, I'll buy you a ticket to India. That was like the catch. And I worked with about 20 people and 10 of them I took with me to India summer 2013.
I remember seeing all these pictures of you with them in India and you had them on some like very intense yoga, working, building like a temple or an ashram for
that was a year later. But the first thing we just went to my friend Vijaya's place from the Sanskrit College, who's a wonderful guy. And I was just love hanging out with him. So, and his father is a very strict Brahmin. And it's just incredible that we managed to bring 10 drug addicts to his house, you know. But while we stayed there, we built some shelters for the poor in that village and we practiced yoga and we had some dialogues about values and stuff like that. And when I came home, the press in Norway came to know about it. So it became a big thing in the press, the, you know, yoga rehabilitation for drug addicts. So suddenly it just got the case picked up and it got a lot of momentum in the press. And then it was this old man, 80 years old, who basically had a daughter who died from an overdose of heroin. And she said, look, I want to give you some money. So he gave me almost $50,000 and said, please take them. I want you to do something good with this money. Okay. Wow. So here I am, just use most of my spending, taking some drug addicts to India. Then I come back and then somebody's giving me $50,000. And I think, I need to do something good with this money. So then I thought, maybe, you know, because during that summer period of 8 weeks in 2013, we stayed in some different farms and, you know, we would do yoga on the weekdays, Monday to Friday at Puro Yoga in Oslo. And then on the weekends, I would take them doing some funny things. We would go to Hemsedal or we'd go to Gaustatoppen or to Telemark and do various things together. And then I remember, you know, a lot of them saying that they miss to have a safe haven to live in, you know, either after prison or being after a drug rehabilitation program. So when that person gave me those $50,000, I thought, I need to do something good with this money. So they basically became the seed money for developing Nursen. And interestingly enough, you know, like the spring, Easter 2013, I said naively, imagine having a yoga retreat center here. And then the next year, 2014, I'm finding myself running around trying to scout out cheap places that I can buy, maybe that we could take over, you know, but I couldn't find anything. And then somebody told me, why don't you go and check out Nursen? Where's Nursen? I don't know where that is. And I go to that very place. And that's the very place where I said naively, imagine having a yoga retreat center here.
Wow. Oh, that's incredible.
And then to cut the long story short, the place, it wasn't really for sale, but I could rent it for free in exchange that I would kind of rehabilitate it and do it up. So I started doing that. And the long story of it is that eventually I was promised that I could buy it, but then I didn't have enough money. And then the neighbor who lived at Nursen, who had a cabin, because eventually Nursen was going to be sold. And the choice was either me that I would buy it or a guy who was doing car racing on the ice. So he was going to have retreats from Germany and Denmark, and he'll come up and do rallycross driving on the winter ice. There's no way I want to have these people around. So, you know, he sits down to me and say, look, here's another 50,000 kroner. Just take it.
Wow.
I want you. So I, you know, received more than $1,000 for free from people just like wanting me to have it. And then to top it off, when I finally signed the deal that, okay, I'm going to buy Nursen, and that was in the autumn of 2015. Then I go to India. We were going with a group of, you know, 12 people from back in the ring, and we were doing some project there. And I'm thinking, oh my God, you know, I've ruined my life. I would never be able to run this yoga retreat center. I'll be going bankrupt. It was just terrible. But while I'm in India, the kind of refugee crisis happened. And suddenly when I came back to Norway 2015, there was a refugee crisis. And the government was basically looking for people who could store these refugees. So then I was able to kind of negotiate the deal with the kind of Norwegian Foreign Office. And we were a refugee center for 100 refugees from December 2015 to March 2016.
Refugees from...
It was Syria, right?
Syrian refugee crisis.
The payment was so good, you know, when we had 100 people and the deal was so good. So we basically made, after all expenses were paid, $100,000 per month. And imagine 3 months running a refugee center. Then we suddenly had the money to rehabilitate the place. And, you know, we exchanged the roof, we exchanged the window, we exchanged everything. So that's wow. the whole story, how kind of nursing developed. And then, of course, it became like we had to be novices trying to run a cafe, a restaurant, a hotel, a retreat center. And then we learned by trial and error. And I had some great people also who helped me and worked there. It was amazing, you know, because I couldn't have done this by myself. But somehow I was the instigator and the instrument of just like landing that whole yoga hotel that we have here now in Norway, which has become a very beautiful place.
Wow. And so it's also a place where you have like many different programs happening, lots of different retreats, but also are there still the addicts that are coming in and, you know, being able to go there and maybe work there or just use that as sort of an intermediary stop between entering real life? Or is there something going on that way?
Well, in the beginning, when we started, you know, the whole kind of Norwegian Justice Department and Drug Rehabilitation Department thought we were just crazy, teaching people yoga, it's never going to work. And, you know, who are these mad people? But now they suddenly, you know, seen the result in some of the people we worked with. So because we've always been open and it's been very important to me that nurses should always have an open space and a big heart for helping people in need as long as they are willing to help themselves. Believe me, we have had some real challenging people there who caused also some troubles to us, you know, but most of the time, if we have somebody who's willing to do the work, it goes smoothly and it goes well. But now we have, you know, two people who are there from the criminal justice department who are doing like the last part of their sentence there. And we have another guy who's finished prison, who's just staying there because he wants to be part of the environment and he feels it's a great place to be. And we have another four people who struggle with drugs that just stay there and help with various things from, you know, cleaning rooms to cooking food and, you know, making coffee, stuff like that. So now we actually started our own rehab, and we even made a website for that. It's called nosenrehab.no, and you can look. It's all in Norwegian, of course. It's not in English. But to me, I want to give something back to society. If we can't give something back, then for what reason are we doing what we're doing? So that was very important for me to have that kind of circular service. We have now some people that are employed full-time, and then we have some people that are volunteering, and then we have these back-in-the-ring people who are just like trying out, helping out, and kind of working on themselves at the same time while they're being there. And most of the time, that goes very smoothly in the interaction with guests because everybody has a lot to learn from service. Service in any way, you know, to your human neighbor, brother, sister, whoever they are. If we can let go of our own stuff and just be of service, we grow as individual. But of course, we make money as a business by being a hotel that, you know, rent out rooms, having yoga retreats, having various conferences and, you know, courses. And now we have some of the top companies in Norway, like Equinor, Yara. They come and they book a few weeks with us every year, you know. They have their HR department or, you know, like a strategy treatment or something like that. So
that's incredible. They'll get you a knighthood in Norway.
A knighthood. But it's such a beautiful location, right? Like it's in the heart of the mountains and there's nature all around. Nature's so healing and so like such a beautiful place for people to go and really connect with, I don't know, the energy of life, the energy within themselves and the energy of the planet, it seems. So I can imagine it's very attractive for all different types of people to go there.
Yeah, you know, of course, you know, to us, it's like heaven and hell at the same time because everything is a double-edged thing. You know, it has a beautiful nature and it's a calm, peaceful environment. But for some other kind of people who are in back in the ring, after some time, they hate it because if they want to go to the shop, it's like 20 kilometers and there's nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. You have to deal with the people that's there. You have to deal with yourself. And sometimes you just want to say, fuck it, I want to get out of here, you know?
Running 20 kilometers is great for their condition.
Some people walk really? That, you know, when they're really, yeah.
You really need to get away. Yeah. I'm going to go walk.
I want to ask you about the ring. I'm sorry, what was it again?
Back in the ring.
I was able to work with a boxing teacher in Milwaukee who was interested in what we were doing. And we had some commonalities and it was exciting, especially around the breath. And he was able to explain to me that how cerebral a sport boxing is, which I had never considered. Like Mike Tyson said, everyone has a plan until they're punched in the face. And so there's this element to boxing that's really like this heaven and hell piece, like you mentioned, that you're trying to maintain your sense of calm and equanimity through the breath because you're panicking because someone's trying to punch you.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this element of violence where you're doing harm and being harmed, but at the same time, you're really hyper-focused on maintaining your breath so that you can think your way like a chess match through a fight. And it's really a thinking man's sport. And I was really fascinated by it. And I wonder if that resonates for you.
Well, definitely. First of all, you know, all the best boxers, the best fighters, they are intelligent fighters. You know, they box with their brain rather than just with their gut or their fist or their muscles. Because it's also saying in boxing, if you get angry, you lose the fight. You know, raw anger. A lot of people think Mike Tyson was just brutal and raw, and he was at a certain time in his life. But, you know, it needs a lot of wakeful thinking and to have a present and not to freak out and not to fear and panic. Because when you panic, well, you freeze and then you normally knocked out. So... Mm-hmm. To me, you know, boxing is brutal. And in the long run, too many blows to the head is not good. But at the same time, when you're in it, and there is that kind of toe-to-toe experience and that energy of finding focus and presence and just being, finding problem solving and realizing there's nowhere to escape. What do you do? It's like the battlefield of the Bhagavad Gita. What do you do when you're so faced with this enormous threat? And this is life, you know, finding a calm, finding a rhythm, finding a balance, not being hard, not responding, reacting in a manic manner, but finding a kind of soft, relaxed way. The best boxers are always the one who, you know, like I say, they're able to be awake in the head rather than instinctive.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons why I called this project Back in the Ring also is because, of course, I had some glory days in boxing when I felt alive and full of energy, and it was a beautiful experience. Of course, there were some blows to the faces and some pain, but there is a rhythm and art and skill in boxing, which is about presence. And if you could find that, you know, you find a presence with life. And also, of course, back in the ring, if you want to get back on your feet after being knocked down by life from either drugs or crime, whatever, it takes some resilience.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to pick yourself up, find that inner strength of you, because nobody else can save you than yourself. You know, you can be your greatest friend or your greatest enemy, but unless you find that support and stability and solid ground of strength within yourself. You know, you can give a drug addict all the treatments in the world, but it's never going to help unless he find that core and strength within himself.
I love this. I feel like this is such a theme for you in your life. As you described the boxing, I feel like it's the same thing that we're kind of searching for and looking for in a yoga practice or a meditation practice or pranayama or you're free diving, you know, it's like all about really taking things to this point in life that's where you're really experiencing presence, like that presence, that concentration, that coming face to face with sort of, I don't know, the essence of life is really like a high for you in a way. And even like your story of creating the retreat center and like, you know, you have nothing. And then people are like, because when you have nothing, you're face to face with this, like this presence, right? Mm-hmm. You got to get really concentrated and
to survive.
And I think there's something in, as you describe this, you know, as you spoke of the Bhagavad Gita, I was thinking about you reading the Bhagavad Gita to Patabi Joyce on, you know, as he's dying and he's in Sanskrit. And I feel like there's so much of the Bhagavad Gita actually being played out in your story, like personally in a way. And I think that kind of like the perfect thing, like the perfect metaphor, like you really are the perfect person to be bringing yoga. And I mean, more importantly, when I say yoga, I mean like this presence, like this ability to help people, to like a chariot people, you know, like be the charioteer of people into that battlefield and the say Krishna. Like, yeah, the Krishna, like this is life, like we're doing it now, and help them to experience the terror and the joy and the peace and all of the things that come up when you're faced with that essence of life or that presence. And it's just really beautiful. It's just like your entire being just was revealed to me, like chapter 11.
Well, you know, like it's interesting how our life turns out and kind of manifests into different shapes and form. Because, you know, when I was spending all that time in Mysore studying Sanskrit, studying the Bhagavad Gita, the Upanishad, the Yoga Sutras, whatever it was, you know, it's like I was going into it with such love and passion and absorption. And of course, I read the Bhagavad Gita at least 1,000 times, you know, and it has festered in me such a, you know, it's given me so much strength to conquer difficulties or to simply just stand up with a kind of straight spine and know that, okay, no matter how difficult it is, or like say with a reference to boxing, when you feel you're knocked out and counted out, but still there is hope as long as you're willing to like step forward and do the work, you know? Mm-hmm. What I taught all of the back in the ring people also, it was Bhagavad Gita. It was like we had a chapter every day. I would go through some passages and teach them, you know, about the essence of each chapter and say, you know, try to reflect like this. And what I'm trying to say is that all that time I had in Mysore studying Sanskrit, kind of trying to facilitate healing to a group of people who is somehow, you know, neglected, and people feel, oh, there's no hope for them. That time there in India, it was just like incredibly valuable. And later, you know, you also have to be a businessman and running a hotel. I never cared about business. I never cared about money, really. I just wanted to study Sanskrit and study yoga. And suddenly you have to make things work, you know, and somehow, you know, the background from the Bhagavad Gita gives you that kind of security and stability to face the challenges and difficulties of life with some kind of composure and balance and trust that, okay, let's see what works out. Let's see what happens now. I don't really know. It could crash. It could fail. But somehow things work out if you're willing to just kind of step up and do the work. And that's what happened with Back in the Ring, because I didn't have the skills myself, thinking I knew how to help in rehabilitation, but the skills I had from yoga and the skills I had from Sanskrit and the Bhagavad Gita and all these great other texts, sharing that gave me an edge of giving them a new experience of themselves and looking at themselves in a new way.
And I love how you bring that in, like life itself is a battlefield, and learning to balance your books or memorizing passages from the Gita, like you have to do both. You can't just like immerse yourself into, you know, the spiritual world. I mean, you can, but I mean, life's still there, right? Especially when you have a family, and especially if you want to give back to other beings, you have to be able to manage yourself as well. And so I feel like that's kind of the part of yoga that sometimes when you're a young practitioner or a young teacher, you think, oh, I'm just going to teach yoga and my whole life's just going to be yoga. And, you know, I'm going to just be able to focus on my spiritual practice and, you know, life's going to be perfect and fine. And there's going to be no difficulties. I'm not going to have to deal with all this bullshit, right?
Yeah, but let's face it, the modern world of yoga is narcissistic. You know, it's being, you know, destroyed by too much I, me, and myself, where it's a kind of luxury problem we have.
It's interesting, like that you say this is a kind of luxury problem, and that like the true yoga is kind of being destroyed by narcissism in a way, and that it's all about like, how can I better myself? How can I like do all these fancy things? And coming from someone who's very advanced, asana practitioner, very advanced.
Very fancy.
Yeah, very fancy, you know.
It's a shame I don't have hardly have any pictures, you know. It's before Instagram and all of that. So
no one knows. No one knows. Mate.
But it kind of gives an interesting viewpoint and perspective of like how do you shift that? Like when people are being so inundated with this idea that that's yoga, and maybe even yourself going so deep into the asana practice, like. I mean, there is like a little confusion that happens sometimes where you start to think that that is yoga. And I mean, your whole life and your whole story, I mean, yoga showing up in all these different ways and areas in your life, and probably even more so now as you're, you know, serving others and facilitating others' journey. But like, how do you kind of get out of that confusion or that illusion that you know, this 2-hour thing you're doing on your mat is yoga?
I think kind of age gave me that benefit, you know, because 10 years ago, I'm 55 now. I mean, 10 years ago, I was 45 and I had an accident with my shoulder and I couldn't really, you know, do some of the great postures anymore. And it didn't look good when I took it with my phone. I wasn't never really too caught up in, you know, just trying to show myself on Instagram. But if it'd been like 20 years ago, I'd probably been all over the place and kind of trying to promote myself in any way I could. But I got really inspired by, you know, the Ramakrishna Mission and the Vivekananda. And of course, you know, also Shivananda, what they've done to the service of yoga. And I think there was, you know, Vivekananda has a quote, you know, to do good and be good. That's the all end of yoga, and you know, to give us some kind of service to humanity. And I also felt like being an asana teacher, which I've been now for, you know, 28 years, and I started teaching yoga in 96 first time. And to me, it was stimulating to see people could relax from doing, but the obsession with postures also kind of appalled me in a way, you know, having a background as a dancer and you've seen it, and you gymnasts can even do it better. So why bother? Yeah. But 10 years ago, I felt like to somehow be of service, although in my naive manner, thinking, oh, I'm going to teach inmates yoga asana and maybe that'd be good for them, you know, and I'm thinking, oh, I bet. Try to do some good work or for drug addicts. But what I realized, it was much more teaching them yoga was just a metaphor for dealing with life and how we are present with life. Because the beauty of a yoga asana class is also you get a direct experience of your body. You have to deal with your aches and pains and tensions and strains and feeling discomfort. And learning to embody a sense of being in the midst of feeling restricted and awkward, and having that practice every day, you know, was the kind of my stepping stone in order to kind of provide some kind of service. But then I couldn't just be an asana teacher, you know, because half of the people couldn't even come to class, or some of the people was just so, you know, inflicted by aches and pains, so they could hardly move their body. So then, you know, the real extension of yoga is bringing it to, you don't have to be an asana teacher or do asana to be a great yogi, is to find focus in the midst of life, here and now, with what you are doing, and appreciating your work, appreciating your relationship, appreciating the connections you have with people. That's the greatest yoga.
Yeah.
But I guess I could have never learned that from not spending, you know, 30 years of practicing serious asana.
That's the irony. Yeah, it is.
But the final thing is, like, you know, it's like Guruji used to say, you know, like, what do you need to understand yoga? Say, primary series is more than enough. If you're little, you know, dull, you have to learn second series. If you're really stupid, then, you know, third series. And
learn third.
Modern world of yoga, we get obsessed with the asana and thinking that's all there is to it. But, you know, nobody will become enlightened from just doing a backbend, no matter how well you can grab your ankles, you know, shins, or whatever. We experience ourselves in relation to others. And when we can keep peace of mind, have a harmonious heart, and feel we can be of some kind of service, and can create surplus and growth and joy to people around us, then we're doing service to yoga. When we're just being caught up with yoga in a narcissistic manner, it becomes just for self-absorption.
Yeah, solipsistic. I just want to thank you so much. It's always such a profound delight talking to you.
When are you going to Noosan?
Soon. I will be there in just a few weeks, actually, at the end of May.
Really?
Yeah, May 30th is the start of...
And how long will you be there?
I will be there for a four-day retreat.
Okay, so no one's going to miss the Mike Tyson fight on Netflix on July 20th with YouTuber Jake Paul. I have to promote that. I am now at the age where I'm like really looking forward to the old man beating the shit out of a kid. We're like, fingers crossed, Jake Paul goes to the hospital. So we'll
there's
see.
Some battles in life. They will always be cruel. Let's have to learn the hard way.
We're looking forward to that. And so look.
And I think I'll see you. Will I see you at the end of May, Alex?
Of course. I'll be there, and you have to come to our house, and we'll treat you. I make a dinner for you, and it'd be wonderful to see you, Harmony. So, Russell, you can't make it.
I'd really like to come, but I was not invited.
Next time. We'll do a big Finding Harmony retreat in Noosan.
We will go to Göteborg next year, and I'm excited. I'm super excited for that. So maybe we can catch up.
I can show you around Gothenburg. I lived 3 years in Gothenburg, so I can take you around to all the secret places. Wow.
You even know how to pronounce it in English. That's amazing.
Gothenburg.
Göteborg.
In Swedish, it's Göteborg. In English, it's Gothenburg. Göteborg.
I'm still saying Göteborg.
Yeah, you got
Göteborg.
You're like somewhere in between.
It's hard to break. We all know that.
Very good.
Next time on the Finding Harmony podcast with Alex, we will talk about samskara.
Right.
Ooh. Yeah.
That's old patterns are hard to break. Right.
Never ending.
We can just do our Duolingo. Beautiful. Before we go. We can study a little bit of Swedish.
Well, thanks for listening to this episode. I hope you loved it. And if you would like to work more intimately with me in a deeper way, then I would invite you to sign up for this four-day retreat I'm teaching at Noosan Mountain Lodge in Norway. This is Alex's retreat center, and I will be teaching there May 30th to June 3rd. It's a retreat called Unlayering, using yoga as a tool for spiritual wellness to increase your energy and fulfillment. And we're going to use all of the somatic practices we have to help release and let go of the patterns, the thoughts and the beliefs, and maybe even the habits that are no longer serving you as a practitioner, and step into a whole new way of embodying yoga within your life. So this is a really beautiful time of connecting and exploring nature in a setting where you can go within and find silence and stillness and solitude, but then also really revitalize your inner well-being, your energy to step into a whole new chapter in your life. I'm excited for this retreat. It's all inclusive. You can find the link in the show notes, and I hope you'll join me May 30th to June 3rd at Nosen Retreat Center. I look forward to meeting you there.
That's it. We've concluded another episode of the Finding Harmony podcast. I just want to thank you so much for doing the work that changes the world, starting with yourself. It truly does make a huge difference. Please make sure you have your automatic downloads turned on wherever you listen so you don't miss any of the upcoming episodes. I have so much more magic I can't wait to share with you. Lastly, if you're on Instagram, I love connecting and hearing from you. So come on over and say hello at Finding Harmony Podcast. And you can also come say hello to me personally at Harmony Slater Official. Thank you again for being here. I cannot wait to share more with you in our next episode.